So hey everybody, welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and for our thousands of friends all over the country, streaming live on the web at www.kpfk.org. So today, Peniel Joseph is going to be our guest. He's written this terrific book called Stokely, A Life. So what we're going to do now is talk about Mississippi Freedom Summer. It's hard to imagine that in 1964, 50 years ago, was what was called the Mississippi Freedom Summer. For most of you who weren't alive during that time or politically aware at that time, and for especially this younger generation of wonderful organizers, it's kind of heartbreaking for me because I don't know how you teach revolution to people who haven't seen a revolution. So a lot of the young organizers today are doing the absolute best they can. They're imagining a revolution they've never seen. But it's very important to understand that we are seeing a revolution, but it's called, unfortunately, a counter-revolution, led by the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, led by U.S. imperialism. That is to say, the demands of the civil rights movement as they evolved into the Black Liberation Movement, as they evolved into an international united front with the people of Vietnam and Cuba, sympathy for China and the Soviet Union, sympathy for what was called the Third World, that revolution, which I call the two decades of the 60s, 1955 to 1975, was such a threat to this government that the attack on the civil rights movement began not after its accomplishments, but during its accomplishments. And in a class struggle, there are always, always a fight between revolution and counter-revolution. It's not like one day there was a counter-revolution and now there's a revolution. But from 55 to 75, the revolutionary forces were in the ascendancy. There was a world revolution that the capitalists were very, very worried about. And they worked during that whole period to suppress other governments, to suppress leaders of the civil rights movement, to assassinate leaders, to beat leaders, to try to create war crimes, which they did in Vietnam to beat back the Vietnamese Revolution, which they failed at. And we're now living in a period of very frightening developments that I don't have to tell you about. So did the civil rights movement win or lose its victories? I think many of the tangible victories of the civil rights movement have been dramatically, dramatically set back. But the worst is the loss of historical memory. So as you know, our show, Voices from the Frontlines, has, among other things, called the Black Revolutionary Thought Project, which evolved out of a conversation between me and Mumia Abu-Jamal, in which we were lamenting the loss of political consciousness of even who was Paul Robeson, who was W.E.B. Du Bois. And now I realize, oh my God, most of you don't know who Martin Luther King was. You don't know who Stokely Carmichael was. You don't know who Malcolm X was. And you don't know James Forman, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. How do we reconstruct this knowledge? So this June 25th to 28th, in Jackson, Mississippi, I can't imagine how many tens of thousands of people, I'm sure, are going to show up for the 50th anniversary of Mississippi Freedom Summer. Now, I'm going to be reading a lot from an excellent book called Stokely, A Life by Peniel Joseph. And Peniel Joseph is from Tufts University, and he's the head of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. And he's written a lot of books about trying to rebuild the Black Power movement. So I'm going to do two things. First, I'm just going to give you a very brief description of what even was Mississippi Freedom Summer. And then I'm going to read you some of his excellent observations about it, and then I'll sort of engage in a conversation with the book rather than the author, who I can't find right now. So the first thing, what was Mississippi Freedom Summer? I think the first thing to understand is that from 1955 at the Montgomery bus boycott, there was a long, long lull between 55 and 61. So Mississippi Freedom Summer, first of all, is a response to a crisis in the civil rights movement, which is black organizers, both from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the Congress of Racial Equality, are still unable to get a Civil Rights Act through Congress. They are unable to get the Kennedy administration to move. They're unable to get the Johnson administration to move. And meanwhile, the South is becoming a military armed camp. So they were at a crisis in the sense that the first thing is that the South, the solid South, was Democratic. And the Democratic Party in the North had no control over the Democratic Party in the South, and in fact was colluding with it most of the time. So one of the ideas of Mississippi Freedom Summer was to bring an integrated, that is, significantly white group of volunteers down South, because they believed that the federal government would respond more to white northern middle class kids going down South whose parents did have influence in our society, or at least some, than black sharecroppers and black working people. Black people, of course, also went down South. There were many students from Howard University, which was a center for real militancy. And during Mississippi Summer, the first thing that happened was the murder of Andrew Goodman, Mickey Schwerner, and James Cheney, which we'll talk about later. And the whole summer was basically organizers going into low-income communities in the South to organize people, to make something happen, and which we'll get to, a real showdown, maybe the greatest historical showdown of the whole civil rights movement, which is in August of 1964 at the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party that shaped so many people's consciousness. You ask people, many people, where did you begin? They'll say Emmett Till. And you ask other people, when did they get radicalized? And they say at the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenge in August of 1964. Peniel, you on the line?
Yes, I am. Hi, Eric.
Okay. So I'm going to read from your book the objective assessments of what actually happened. Then we're going to talk more about the political interpretation. So on page 77, it says, Freedom Summer's chaotic conclusion in Atlantic City overshadowed the project's remarkable achievements. On August 29th, SNCC issued a press release that summarized the summer project's official results. The drive, which began on June 21st and ended that week, recruited hundreds of students, doctors, lawyers, preachers, and ministers to Mississippi to coordinate efforts that centered on freedom schools, voter registration, and political action. 175 freedom school teachers taught over 2,000 students enrolled in 41 freedom schools spread through 20 different communities. Project workers organized an additional 13 community centers that established libraries, literacy programs, health and child care programs. In the towns of Milestone and Harmony, civil rights workers and local people were building two new centers from the ground up. More than 55,000 African Americans successfully filled out freedom registration forms, symbolically proving that democracy remained in the hearts and in the minds of Mississippi blacks, if it was not yet a political reality. So, my friend, welcome to Voices from the Frontlines, Peniel Joseph. How you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, going into the 50th anniversary, which we're both going to be at in Jackson, looking back at it, what would you say is the historical significance? Obviously, you've written a book about it, as many, but what are some of the things that the new generation today would not understand about the political significance of Mississippi Freedom Summer?
Well, I think the political significance is really hugely connected with antebellum slavery and really resistance to white supremacy and as well as black self-determination in the Deep South. So when you think about Mississippi that Bob Moses and Stokely Carmichael encounter, and people like Amzie Moore, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer, Annell Ponder, all these different women and men who are very much unsung heroes, some still living, many who have passed away, they were living in the context of racial slavery and capitalist exploitation. And so when you think about what was SNCC doing there, SNCC wasn't the first that had tried through Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to help galvanize local people. But Freedom Summer and really the politics of the early 1960s are very, very important. So going into Macomb, Mississippi in 1961, Bob Moses, it's not successful, and he's, in jail talking about they're in Mississippi, the tip of the iceberg. But it becomes inspirational to then regroup in Greenwood and really to make the Delta a base for a political revolution. I think what people would be surprised of is, one, the organizing that black and white people, activists including Stokely Carmichael, Charlie Cobb, many of the people who and have met and worked with and had on your show did, but also the way in which local people, because sometimes we get overwhelmed because of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman and their assassination, and the white volunteers. So there were heroic, white volunteers, some more than others. A few hundred of them wanted to stay and did stay, but over 1,000 when we think about the lawyers, the doctors, the advisors, along with the students. But local people were active too, and there were black activists, especially the Howard contingent was very active. So you're going to have Stokely there, and you're going to have different African American activists who are there. But I think people would be surprised at the hands-on organizing. Freedom Summer and the Summer Project is sort of Bob Moses, Allard Lowenstein, and others. But then when we think about the Freedom Schools, that's Charlie Cobb, but that's Charlie Cobb by way of Highlander Folk School and people like Septima Clark and Miles Horton.
Well, let me stop you there for a minute, because it's in reading, a lot of your book, one of the things I'm just struck by is almost every sentence you say is a book in itself. How do we get people to understand Septima Clark? How do we understand Miles Horton, Highlander School? Just everything you said, Charlie Cobb. Couple of thoughts. I mean, you have I started the thing I sent out as an email that said that Lenin said that there's some centuries in which a year happened and some years in which a century happened. And I think the 1955 to 1975 was a 20-year period in which it seemed like a century happened every year. You have a quote, a lot of them I know by heart, I can't find the page, where you say, in an 18-month period, Stokely went through an entire political lifetime of political change. Why don't you explain some of that, the evolution? I think, for instance, as an example, how many people do not understand that many of the leaders of the Black Panther Party came from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee? So that's as one in terms of a rapid evolution. But why don't you tell us what you think were some of the major changes on his journey of 18 months?
Yeah, certainly. I think one of the things when we think about Stokely, Carmichael Kwame Ture, is when he's an activist even before he joined SNCC. So he's going to be mentored by people like Bayard Rustin, who I think we all know of as the organizer of the March on Washington. But really, Bayard is the most important black social democrat of the post-war period. So when we think about the post-war American history, there's certainly A. Philip Randolph is a father of a kind of labor activism and trade unionism that goes back to the 1920s when he was a socialist with Chandler Owen selling the Messenger in Harlem and saying they were the only black socialists in the United States. Hmm. But Bayard Rustin, along with people like A.J. Musty, along with William Worthy, along with Ella Baker, Fellowship of Reconciliation, In Friendship, they were part of a groundswell of grassroots activists who were willing to go to jail rather than serve in World War II as conscientious objectors, but who also traveled to India and Africa tutored and helped mentored and were mentored by people like Nkrumah and others. So really extraordinary activists. So Stokely is going to be mentored by that, and he's mentored by Pan-Africanists in Harlem, but also a white, predominantly Jewish left in New York City. So he's coming out of these multiple traditions. So by the time he comes to SNCC, he has all that politics in him. But certainly from 60 to 64, he travels a lifetime. And then from 64, when we think about Freedom Summer in the next 18 months, it is like a century, because One of the things, there's a great quote from Mendy Samstein, who is somebody I know you knew, who says that Bayard, you're a traitor. He's yelling at Bayard Rustin at the Democratic National Convention, because Bayard Rustin is saying that MFDP and Fannie Lou Hamer should take the deal of two non-voting delegates. So Mississippi, or the DNC, breakswnot only Stokely Carmichael's heart, but many activists, including people like Bob Moses, go in a different direction. So part of that 18-month period is going to be going from, you know, organizing Freedom Summer and organizing the Summer Project to going down to the Democratic National Convention in August, and at the same time that Mrs. Hamer is saying, is this America, you've got activists who are on the boardwalk holding up huge placards of Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, you know, offering up witness to what happened in Mississippi. Because I think one of the things your readers, your viewers, it's hard to understand that Mississippi buys tanks and guns and says that an invasion is coming when nonviolent citizens are coming to practice democracy in the summer of 64. So when people talk about American gulag, And white supremacy, Mississippi was the face of that, you know. And there's no wonder the news story by Coates in the Atlantic, when they're looking at, you know, the case for reparations, Clyde Ross, 1923, he's born in Mississippi. So the people were doing God's work in Mississippi, because Mississippi was ground zero for not just institutional racism, but white supremacy. But the interesting thing about Stokely and where he travels, so he goes from Mississippi to Alabama. And the interesting part about Alabama is that they use Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. to get them into Alabama. So they're going to be playing Malcolm's tapes in Lowndes County, Alabama. But Stokely will admit himself, it's King's Selma to Montgomery demonstration that provides him the galvanizing force to go into Lowndes. And the known fact about Stokely is that he actually marches with King on that Selma to Montgomery demonstration.
Well, one of the things that I knew both from Clay Carson's book and now from yours, and also I was there, you know, is that Stokely had a lot more respect for King. You know, King was, of course, a very complicated figure, in that he would come in, often parachute in, make deals that nobody on the ground had agreed to, parachute out and not be aware of the implications of a lot of stuff that he did. There were many of us, I mean, us in the Congress of Racial Equality and SNCC at the time, who were very critical of King. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I think we didn't understand enough what he was doing, you know, I mean, how much space he had opened up, what a heroic figure he was within all those weaknesses. And I think that in your book you point out that Stokely had a much better appreciation of that, because when you went into the countryside, the first question they say, are you with Dr. King? And Stokely would always say, we sure are. So why don't you evolve that, because the difference between, why don't you talk about the difference between Stokely's perception of King and James Forman's?
Yeah, that's a great example. Forman, you know, is very much critical of King and you know, really is resentful of the fact that King takes up so much media space, public relations space, but also gets so much credit in the black community, including credit for things that, quite frankly, he's not doing.
Right.
Credit for things that SNCC is doing, specifically, and CORE is doing, and just grassroots activists are doing. So Forman is hugely, hugely critical, and in a way is very competitive with King, antagonistic, whereas Stokely... and I think the reason why Stokely is different is, one, I mean, he's a political strategist, because he has been politicized and he's a community organizer even while a high school student at Bronx Science. And two, you know, he first meets King in 1963 at Howard University. So his perspective on King is different. And then he serves as a bodyguard chauffeur for King in Greenwood for a week. And he always recalls the way in which black people absolutely, you know, loved King. You know, you know, he's one of the folks who, you know, King is obviously killed in 1968, who was a very good friend with Martin Luther King Jr., and says that King, for whatever faults he had, loved black people unconditionally. And also Stokely credits King with teaching him and the entire black community how to protest and organize and resist racism and white supremacy without fear, because he says that he's seen King. And remember, in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman are killed, Stokely and King revisit that place 2 years later, and he says he's seen King face down mobs. And, you know, the news reports of the time, and I don't know if you were there at that particular, event. I think it's around June 21st. It's right a few days before the end of the Meredith March. News reports say there's an angry mob in Philadelphia that's liable to do anything. Like, Dr. King's life is in real danger. People talk about Cicero, Chicago, and where people are throwing bricks and stones at King and his mobs. But there's a huge mob in Philadelphia, and King and Stokely and the whole group, you know, barely get out of Philadelphia, Mississippi alive. And King calls it, remember the quote, is the worst place he's ever seen.
That's right. Well, just to be clear about my own background, Pinnell, that I did all my work in the North. So I worked with CORE in Harlem. I organized the Trailways bus boycott in 1964-65 against what Fannie Lou Hamer used to say, the racism up north. And we took on the Port Authority bus terminal that at the time was hiring no black people to drive buses or to be ticket agents or to be information clerks in the North in 1964-65. I worked closely with Ralph Featherstone on some stuff. I was very close with SNCC, but through the, you know, and then I worked at the Newark Community Union Project for 3 years in the black
Featherstone
community.
Featherstone and Che Payne were assassinated.
Right, right. So I'm just saying only to be that I didn't pay my dues down south and have enormous, enormous respect for what people have done, but I was totally, you know, very close to all the figures that you mentioned because it was a national movement. I want to hop to the MFDP for a minute because, and the discussion of Rustin, you know, I think it's very complicated today because in the gay liberation movement, there's an effort to correctly resurrect Rustin in terms of, you know, all the horrible stuff that was done to him in terms of his sexual orientation. But there's also an effort at hagiography, or whatever you call it, to not understand the great, phenomenal anger that we had towards Rustin. I was very lucky because Fannie Lou Hamer came to Newark and met with us, and I'll tell you some things after you tell us talk. But she gave us a 2.5-3 hour breakdown of the negotiations with her, Rustin, Walter Reuther, King, Hubert Humphrey, and every other mother they could send in there to try to hammer her and Bob Moses and Stokely and how they held out, you know, and what she learned from that. So I'll tell you a little afterwards, but why don't you tell me, since your book does such a good job, tell our listeners just about what that deal was, what the fight was about, and why would somebody at the end, as you say, consider Byatt Rustin a false prophet? That is to say, Stokely considered him that, given how much respect Stokely had for him. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about that story?
Well, certainly. The MFDP grows out of, SNCC's organizing and local people's organizing in Mississippi for the right to vote and citizenship and deep democracy in Mississippi. Fannie Lou Hamer had been radicalized in 1962 by SNCC, and she was from Ruleville, Mississippi, and she was a sharecropper, one of many kids, had children of her own. She had been misdiagnosed. She had a fractured hip when she was younger, and she walked which never healed properly, and she walked with a limp for the rest of her life. She had also been brutalized in Winona, Mississippi in 1963 and beaten both by white authorities, but they had also had black inmates and forced black inmates to beat her and other activists, too, in 1963. So Fannie Lou Hamer becomes really a great, courageous example of when we talk about local leadership. You know, Malcolm X called her one of the country's foremost freedom fighters, but Stokely really reveres her. So if you really want a measure of who Stokely Carmichael, you know, Kwame Ture was, you look at his relationship with not just King, but Fannie Lou Hamer. And there's a great interview with Stokely and Studs Terkel in 1965, and Courtney Cox and other people are there in Chicago, and Stokely is saying that the country has more Fannie Lou Hamers than Martin Luther King's, and we need to accept Fannie Lou Hamer because she is more representative of the black community than Martin Luther King, even though, you know, he's got tremendous respect and love for King. So he always felt that the measure of American democracy was the measure that they would embrace Fannie Lou Hamer, not just as a citizen, but as a political leader. You know, somebody who, even though she had been not formally educated, was a really brilliant woman, intelligent woman, and a very, very courageous woman. So when we think about MFDP, yes, Fannie Lou Hamer becomes representative, and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party tries to displace the white supremacist, all-white segregated delegation at the DNC. So they hold a nominating convention. There's about 68 delegates, four of whom are white. It's an interracial convention. And basically, they want to be seated officially at the DNC. Now, Lyndon Johnson is aghast at this because he doesn't want not only the Mississippi regulars to walk out, he doesn't want the entire South to walk out on national television. And so, basically, the MFDP, during the Democratic National Convention, become a cause célèbre. And white liberals and black delegates that have real official seats actually give them seats, so they're there. They're on the floor. And you know, basically they're politicking, and Stokely and others are part of it. And eventually, you know, Lyndon Johnson sends Hubert Humphrey, and Humphrey sends people like Walter Mondale, who's not a senator at the time, to basically try to shut up the Mississippi Democratic Party, and they successfully destroy small d democracy there. And that's where Stokely says, you know, they're offered two non-voting seats. Byard is Rustin by 64 is past his prime. So the Rustin, who's the freedom fighter, who's a radical social democrat, that ends with the March on Washington. So it's an interesting career, because then it's much more conventional American liberal politics, with all the reactionary elements that entails, especially since he's so beholden to a liberal labor alliance. So, you know, Vietnam, so many different contradictions there. So Rustin says, take the deal. And that's when, you know, Mendy Samstein calls him a traitor. And again, Rustin had debated Malcolm X, for God's sake, in 1961. Rustin had helped organize garment workers with Stokely. Rustin had done all these heroic activities. He had been imprisoned not only because of, you know, his sexuality, but because he was a conscientious objector. So this was somebody who, in a specific historical time, you know, radiated dignity and radiated a real soul force. And that changed. That changed. You know, so the Byard Rustin of 1942, who's writing essays about resisting racial segregation and being on a bus and being brutalized for resisting racial segregation, is not the same Byron Rustin of 1964. Something changed. And so what's interesting for Stokely is that Stokely remains consistent, and in fact wants to be deeper in terms of social political transformation, and as we'll see by 66, anti-imperialism. So when we think about the MFDP is an example of a sitting U.S. president undermining American democracy, you know, right before our eyes. Because one story your listeners should know as well is that Lyndon Johnson, he ends the live coverage of Fannie Lou Hamer's testimony to the Credentials Committee, where she is saying, "Is this America?" And she's saying, "You know, we're beaten like animals for wanting to live," like she says, "as decent human beings." Lyndon Johnson is watching this from the White House and calls an impromptu press conference, and it ends that live coverage. It interrupts the live coverage of Fannie Lou Hamer. So that's the United States of America that Stokely finds himself in 64. And again, rather than either aligning himself and becoming a comprador and becoming a collaborator, or just running away, he just dives deeper into radical political self-determination and tries to organize sharecroppers in Lowndes County, Alabama, for their own political party, which is going to be the Lowndes County Freedom Organization. And there's SNCC activists like Judy Richardson, you know, the late Bob Mantz, Scott Smith. There's going to be many who go into Lowndes. John Hewlett is one of the local organizers, and that's eventually what's going to become called the Black Panther Party in 1966, even before the Oakland Panthers. So the interesting part of MFDP is the MFDP exposes the lie of small d democracy at the grassroots level. They had played by the rules, they did everything they were supposed to do, and they were crushed, and there were black and white liberals telling him and telling them, these poor black people, that this is how the game is played.
Yeah, let me tell you, the Fannie Lou, exactly, this is how the game is played. You're listening to Peniel Joseph, who's written a really terrific book called Stokely, A Life. We're talking about Mississippi Freedom Summer. And listen, I'm deciding not to go to the phones, folks, and I want to tell you why. because this, I think this is just too rich and it's too rare to get this conversation in. We normally go to the phones. When I come back in a week, you know, we're going to be doing a lot on Mississippi Freedom Summer and a lot on this history, but I want to, we have about 12 minutes left and I want to make sure we can use some of this more. So, Peniel, I just want to tell you a couple of stories that totally reinforce your stories. We're in Newark, New Jersey. We're organizing in the Black South and Central Ward. And Tom Hayden, who has very close ties with SNCC, somehow gets Van Nieuwenhuyzen to come to meet with us as organizers. And the first thing is that we're up on the second floor. I don't know why we got a second floor office, and she had a heck of a time getting up the stairs. Mm. And the first thing she said is, folks, if you don't know enough to have a storefront, you don't even know organizing 101. I'm not walking up these stairs one more time. Next time I come back, you better have a storefront. We got one in 30 days. So that was the first point. And the story that she told us was that, as you said, the so-called compromise was to have two at-large non-voting delegates who would be sitting from the so-called Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party while the white regular Democratic Mississippi delegation was completely seated. They would have the right to vote. MFDP, of course, had no votes. So what was this even compromise about? It was ridiculous. And so the way she explained it to us is that there was Walter Ruther there. There was Bayard Rustin there. There was, at one point, Hubert Humphrey came in and said, you have to take this compromise because, number one, if you take this compromise, I could become vice president of the United States, which would be terrific for the civil rights movement. And Van Nieuwenhuyzen says, with all due respect, Mr. Humphrey, we didn't risk our lives in Mississippi so you could become vice president of the United States. We thought you're supposed to risk your life for the people in Mississippi. So you got your values all wrong. The second thing is that she said to Bayard that it's okay if you want to propose a deal, but do not threaten us. How dare you threaten us as if we're going to destroy Lyndon Johnson's chances, Gold War is going to get elected, all these threats against us. I mean, if you want to make the case, it's a bad case. But to be in a closed-door session, hammered away by the liberals, was a tremendous lesson. And she said, so there's several lessons I want you to understand about this. She said, the first thing is, we are always open to a possible compromise. But in every compromise, somebody wins and somebody loses. The question is, did we win? Were they offering us a winning compromise, like half the regular delegation would be seated and half the MFDP? We would have taken that. But we weren't offered that. She said, so remember, the word compromise is neither good or bad. Who at the end of the day wins? And the second thing is, the way you know if it's a good compromise is, can you go back to your base, explain the conditions you are under, explain the decisions you made, and are you going to be in danger for your life, or will you be respected? She said, there's no way I'm going back to Mississippi with this deal. This is a horrible deal. So those things have shaped my organizing life my whole life, and the fact that she, as a sharecropper, could stand up to all these heavyweights and say no was such a radicalizing experience for me. Now, my question to you is, while many of us, and us, I mean, the civil rights radicals and revolutionaries, this was our experience. Why did many people in Mississippi still decide to stay inside the Democratic Party to reform it after this horrible experience?
Well, I think the reason why they decided to stay is because there was the feeling that the Democratic Party was the only game in town that had institutional and political power to provide the goods and services that they needed for their day-to-day lives. So I think that they would have, if they could have been offered an alternative that was institutionalized enough that had growing power and a growing base. And I think you saw that with the LCFO, and Stokely had a dream of doing national Panther Party that would be, different from what the Oakland Panthers eventually turned out to be, but that would be people running for office, that would be an independent black politics that was accountable to the black community. I think that if Seattle, for instance, right now has a socialist that was just elected. I mean, if people would have ran for office as independents and won, I think that would have offered an alternative narrative. So I think that the Democratic Party was really, because remember, in the South at the time before 68 and the midterms of 66, and certainly the Nixon-Wallace-Humphrey election of 68, the South was really, what most Americans don't understand, the South was a one-party state. I mean,
right.
You know, Alabama, you look at a place like Alabama or South Carolina or Mississippi, there were no Republicans to speak of. You know what I mean? It was literally a one-party state. It's one of the reasons, you know, Ira Katz Nelson has the fabulous book, Fear Itself, about the New Deal and the Dixiecrats and the Congress.
Hmm.
And, you know, there's no way Roosevelt could get anything done without the Dixiecrats. You know, the compromise, and you just were talking about compromises, that the Democratic Party itself, I mean, it loses its soul because it sells its soul to the white supremacist wing of the party, and the New Deal is two-tiered liberalism, one for whites, one for blacks. And so that's the compromise, which is why, you know, the black people get housing projects and dirt roads, and the white people get Levitt towns and GI bills, and you don't get access even if you fought in World War II for the most part. So that's what's going on. So there's a huge problem there, but it also means that the Democratic Party is this hegemonic party, and Fannie Lou Hamer and these sharecroppers, they weren't stupid. I mean, if you could have provided them offered them a different alternative that provided institutional power. And you know, money and bridges and roads and schools and jobs, they would have been for it. But they knew that it was just the Democratic Party. And, you know, in large part, they were right in the sense of the way in which history has unfolded. I mean, I don't think it's been the best thing for them. And poor people in Mississippi, you think about black people in Mississippi, still suffering, even though it's got the most black elected officials in the country. But they'll never, until they get 51% there, they're never going to have black senators, governors, away from sort of a segregated electoral victories based on, racial segregation. So it's very interesting.
Peniel, I want to interrupt you just for a minute because I want to get you to address one more point. I mean, just briefly, it's why I still believe there is a black nation in the Black Belt South and why there needs to be territorial integrity and, you know, questions like that. But I want to end with, you know, of course, Stokely Carmichael changed his name to Kwame Ture. And the last 5 minutes, I'd like you to talk about his movement towards Pan-Africanism, the choices he made, his assessment of the world, and why he went from Mississippi to Africa obviously an extension of that work, in no way a repudiation. But help our listeners understand a little better. And you have about 4 minutes, and we'll keep going many other times.
Oh, certainly. I think that when we think about Stokely, 66, black power is a turning point. But the black power turning point, and, you know, he's Stokely still from 66 to 69, and really publicly Kwame Ture 78, 79, the black power point really has all the vestiges of the anti-imperialism and the revolutionary Pan-Africanism that we're gonna see. So basically, by 66, he's chairman of SNCC. He's calling for radical black self-determination. He calls for black power in Greenwood, Mississippi, June 16th, 1966, becomes a national leader, and then really becomes the country's biggest anti-war protester, before King, before Muhammad Ali. And there's the best way to best speech to see in this period is the October 29th, 66 Berkeley speech, where he's talking about white supremacy, he's talking about white privilege, talking about the war in Vietnam, and he challenges the whites in the audience to make democracy work and to resist the war and resist really what he's calling American imperialism. He's quoting Malcolm X, Frantz Fanon, Albert Camus, Jean-Paul Sartre, you know, all these different things. And by 67, 68, we're going to see that manifest itself more. He becomes a global figure. He's with Fidel in Cuba. He's with Nkrumah and Ture in Conakry. He's with Nyerere in Tanzania. And he becomes prime minister of the Black Panther Party by 68. So the move is based on his own personal experiences and what's happening politically. He makes the argument that following Nkrumah, there should be a United States of Africa, one party, one leader, one nation, and that there's really not a difference between the Mississippi Delta and the sharecroppers he was working with in Lowndes County, Alabama, and the folks he finds and he works with in Conakry and Dalaba and other parts of Guinea. So that becomes the argument. He becomes this real vociferous anti-imperialist and this revolutionary who's arguing that it's only a pan-African revolution that can transform the lives of black people, not only in Africa, but in the United States. And he considers himself African. He considers himself, he's from Trinidad, he lived in the United States, he spends the last 30 years in Africa. He considers himself African, and all black people, wherever they are, he calls them African.
Well, I think that was great. And the voice you were listening to is Peniel Joseph, who's written a terrific book called Stokely a Life. He's also running an excellent center for the study of race and democracy at Tufts. I got beat up at Tufts trying to integrate Tufts with Chuck Turner as white construction workers almost killed us as we tried to, seriously, in 66.
Well, no, I mean, thank you for your service. I mean, I think that those are the stories people need to know, because it was everywhere. You talked about, you know, your activism in the North. People paid heavy dues in the North as well, and I think there's great new books, you know, about that, whether it's Segru's Sweet Land of Liberty or Brian Purnell's new book on CORE and in Brooklyn, you know, a movement grows in Brooklyn, that people need to really understand that story. And Tom Hayden's a friend. I was in Los Angeles at Esalen with him talking about Stokely. And, you know, really incredible, heroic work. And he's still doing it. You're still doing it. So the great part about talking about people like Stokely and Fanny is to show people that it really mattered, because these things happened. And I agree with you that that period of 55-75, you know, centuries did happen in decades, you know.
Well, it looks like Peniel's very great. I hope, I'm sure we're going to be seeing each other in Jackson. I'm sure we're going to be doing a lot of work together. Thank you so much for being on Voices from the Frontlines. I really enjoyed getting to know you through your terrific book and through talking to you today, and let's have you on again soon.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, so listen, that's it. We have to get out of here. This is Voices from the Frontlines. This is Eric Mann, your host. And I had a really great time, learned a lot. I think this show makes me read a lot. I have to read all these really good books. So we will be back next week. Manuel Criollo, one of the very finest organizers, is going to host the show while I'm away. And they're going to talk about the MTA work. I want to thank everybody at KPFK, and I'll see you next Tuesday. Voices from the Frontlines. Put it in your book every Tuesday at 4. Take good care of yourselves.